You can argue your position most effectively if you understand what persuades those who argue against you.
The Tikva Fund presents How Fiction Differs from Philosophy, the seventh episode of an eight-part series on George Eliot's classic novel, Daniel Deronda, led by Professor Ruth Weiss.
The introduction of Daniel's mother is one of the most intriguing parts of this novel, because there you have a character who is so complicated, and you would think such a negative character in terms of all that the book wants to present to us. A woman who gives up her own son. A woman who not only draws away from Judaism, but who gives you strong arguments as for everything that is wrong with it, who feels that to liberate yourself means to liberate yourself first and foremost from being Jewish, from being constrained by your Jewishness, by your particularism, and by this particularism, because it makes so many demands on you. What interests me about this particular chapter of the book, this particular section of the book, is that she is presented so powerfully, so that you almost think, hey, wait a minute, whose side is this novel on? But I think that this, too, is part of George Eliot's genius here. She wanted us to feel the full thrust of what stands against all the ideas that this book stands for. I thought this session would be entitled How Fiction Differs from Philosophy, and begin with William Blake, who thought that Paradise Lost, which is John Milton's reimagined story of the Garden of Eden, one of the great poems of English literature, he thought this was a very great poetic work, and yet he had this to say of its author. The reason Milton wrote in fetters when he wrote of angels and God, and at liberty when of devils and hell, is because he was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it. Now, this piece of literary criticism is almost as famous as Paradise Lost itself, and I think that could only be because so many readers found some truth in Blake's observation. Blake maintained what he was saying is that the most vivid and persuasive parts of Milton's work were the sections featuring Satan, whereas the heavenly characters who were supposedly meant to be represent the good and represent the moral aspect of his work felt as if the author had forced himself to create them, namely wrote them when he was in fetters, in chains. Blake said that this was because Milton was more poet than theologian, perhaps implying that subconsciously the poet would side with the devil because he shared much of his point of view, or because Satan was a more intriguing literary challenge. But this could also be taken, I think, as a general statement about literature, which sometimes has an easier time attracting our attention through evil and menace than through sweetness and light. So many critics have found the affirmative Deronda sections of the novel flatter than the Gwendolyn saga, and then some of the other parts. In today's language, I would say that some of these critics found that the hero was too straight. Henry James said, all the Jewish part is at bottom cold. And there seems to be, at least in my reading of things, some correlation between those who found the Jewish part cold and those who had a rather cold spot in their heart for the Jews. But that would require a different investigation in which we matched all the critics with their responses to the novel to see the extent to which this actually holds true. Our reactions to the novel of ideas, as I've suggested already, are bound to depend. They must depend to some degree on whether or not we share those ideas. And as George Eliot correctly foresaw, the proper Englishmen and their admirers would not go for a novel that tried to correct their flaws through a Jewish deliverer. But for the moment, the part of Blake's comment that interests me relates to the Princess Leonora Halm Eberstein, who impresses me as one of the most vivid characters I've ever encountered in literature. In creating her, was George Eliot of the Devil's Party without knowing it? Did she enjoy creating this character even more than Gwendolyn, let alone Deronda and Mira? Well, there was certainly a lot of the author in this woman, as we know. Mary Ann Evans, before she became George Eliot, had dramatically challenged her father when she determined not to attend church. Her rebellion brought about a rupture with her family that was never healed. This was a woman who took a man's name, a woman who lived with an already married man who never had children, although she did care for the children of her lover. George Eliot, by the way, also, I think, was suffering from kidney stones and in pain during the writing of this book. And one can almost feel the princess grimacing as she speaks. The salon culture of Germany was founded by women, several of whom felt about Judaism just as the princess does in this book, and George Eliot knew some of them. So for all these reasons, is Leonora's mutiny more dramatically compelling than Deronda's consent? So the meeting between son and mother takes place in the climactic seventh book, between the time that Grandcourt strong-arms Gwendolyn into joining him on the yacht on the Mediterranean and that fateful day they go sailing together. So having thirsted to know this mother, whom he imagines yearning equally for him, Deronda is instead summoned by a cryptic note from one Leonora Helm Eberstein that asks him to wait for her in Genoa, the son who has been waiting for her all his life. The buildup to this scene could not be more dramatic, and when they meet, it was, quote, something like a greeting between royalties, a description that kind of suggests formal stiffness and a princely aura that's not compatible with the reconciliation scene where family members unite in many other novels or dramas with a great deal more passion and feeling. The exchange between them takes us back to the moral insecurity of the opening paragraph. The mother says, "You are a beautiful creature. I knew you would be. I am your mother, but you can have no love for me." Deronda says, "I have thought of you more than any other being in the world," to which she replies, "I am not what you thought. I am not like what you thought I was." She proceeds then to disabuse him of any notion he may have harbored of reunion with a lost parent. As the first meeting between Daniel and Gwendolyn upsets our expectations of traditional romance, this chilly encounter upsets any thought we may have harbored of the essential maternal nature of women. May I suggest that the next time we are tempted to croon about Jewish mothers, or in Yiddish, my Yiddish mame, we call to mind this scene of modern Jewish motherhood that rather reverses the story of Moses, doesn't it? The Jewish mother trying to hand her son over to the Egyptians, in this case the English, to save him from having to remain a Jew. As I say, there were plenty of models for such a portrait in the women whom I call, not very kindly, the Jewish salon keepers of Germany, like Rachel Lewin, like Henrietta Hertz, and others. And Leonora's intensity in rejecting the Jews is a match for Mordechai's intensity in championing them. So actually, Leonora's antipathy and the way she accounts for it are much more substantial than Mordechai's description of who and what inspired the Jewish enthusiasm in him. The psychological roots of Leonora's defection are more fleshed out than Mordechai's enthusiasm, which he takes on faith. It's hard for Jews who feel passionately about their civilization to convey to others why Judaism matters, why the survival of the Jews matters. It seems easier to tell others why one would want to leave it all behind. And Yiddish and Hebrew literature were once thick with memoirs of young people fleeing or having fled the Jewish authority of their homes. And nowadays, may I say that this is a genre that keeps repeating itself? Nowadays, we are once again flooded by memoirs of refugees from Haredi homes and communities that were made much stronger after the Second World War in a defensive posture. And now, once again, you have a new Haskalah literature emerging in our midst. The same stories, the same impulses. Amazing to see the same genre of literature really recurring. But I would ask, is there any one of them that holds a candle to a passage like this, which is one of the passages of the Princess Helm Eberstein as she confronts her son? Your grandfather never comprehended me, or if he did, he thought only of fettering me into obedience. I was to be what he called the Jewish woman under pain of his curse. I was to feel everything I did not feel and believe everything I did not believe. I was to feel awe for the bit of parchment in the mezuzah over the door, to dread lest a bit of butter should touch a piece of meat, to think it beautiful that men would bind the tefillin on them and women not, to adore the wisdom of such laws, however silly they might seem to me. I was to love the long prayers in the ugly synagogue and the howling and the gabbling and the dreadful fasts and the tiresome feasts and my father's endless discoursing about our people, which was a thunder without meaning in my ears. I was to care forever about what Israel had been, and I did not care at all. I cared for the wide world and all that I could represent in it. I hated living under the shadow of my father's strictness. Teaching, teaching, for everlasting, this you must be, that you must not be, pressed on me like a frame that got tighter and tighter as I grew. I wanted to live a large life with freedom to do what everyone else did and be carried along in a great current, not obliged to care. Ah! And here her tone changed to one of a more bitter incisiveness. Ah! You are glad to have been born a Jew. You say so. That is because you have not been brought up as a Jew. That separateness seems sweet to you because I saved you from it. So I think if you were asked to audition for the theater, here's a monologue to go with. The grievance of an intelligent woman who feels unjustly inhibited on so many counts as a woman demeaned by not having been assigned the same duties as a man, an independent thinker who is not allowed to think for herself, a resident of Europe exposed to European refinement, yet confined to her noisy shul and told that she must not partake of everything to which she is attracted. This is a glorious person who is eager to test herself in the world, but straitjacketed, as she feels it, into a narrow Jewish fate. And the cruelest cut in her conception of freedom as freedom from Jewishness is the charge that Duranda can only be glad to be a Jew because he was not brought up as one. Her accumulated bitterness wins our attention for the brilliance with which it is expressed, and I think that the woman gains our sympathy for the illness that is crippling her and about to end her life. So just as the debaters in the Philosopher's Club at the Hand and Banner present the intellectual case against Jewish national self-liberation, Leonora's words, delivered with theatrical power, project the emotional case against a tribal religion. As part of this argument, Mordechai insists, as part of his argument, in the Philosopher's Club, Mordechai insists that feeling takes precedence over ideas. And here we see how he may be right. The intellectual case for Jewish nationalism against its critics could be made by way of analogy, as Moses Hess did in Rome and Jerusalem, by comparing Jewish national revival with the Italian Risorgimento, or as Mordechai compares it with the founding of America. This is the way a rational case would be made. How long is it? Only 2 centuries since a vessel carried over the ocean the beginning of the great North American nation. The people grew like meeting waters. They were various inhabitant sect. There came a time a century ago when they needed a polity, and there were heroes of peace among them. What had they to form a polity with but memories of Europe corrected by the vision of a better? So everyone at the Philosopher's Club insisted on rationality, and Mordechai makes the altogether logical and reasonable case for a Jewish homeland as part of a universal pattern of emerging nation states. And then in the 19th century, the Bible was still the best-selling book in Europe, and everyone knew that the land of Israel was the promised land of the Jewish people. Moreover, wherever nationalist sentiment spilled over into the wish for a cohesive ethnic country with a cohesive ethnic culture, one could appeal on an analogous basis, at least from a logical perspective, to the idea of Jews returning to their homeland. Once you granted that Jews were a people and that the people of and that they were the people of the Bible, it was not hard to make the case for Zionism on the grounds of ideas and on the idea of fairness. The idea for a familial religion, the case for a familial religion transmitted through birth, through kinship, through blood, was far harder to reconcile with the Enlightenment and with emancipation's competing idea of individual rights and freedoms. So Leonora is raised under her father's authority as Jews felt themselves to stand under the power of God through the mediating authority of rabbis and heads of the community and their fathers. This had been the way of transmitting Judaism. And traditional Jews remained bound by Judaism in the same way. And we see Mira remaining bound by that same loyalty even as she considers herself a deficient Jew because she no longer follows the rituals of its way of life. But Leonora's was a generation with the opportunity to escape that authority. Her husband, you see, is no longer willing to command her, or perhaps, knowing that he is not going to be able to command her, prefers to let her have her way. Leonora speaks like a prisoner who has won her release without granting any recognition to the civilization that had made her so competent and so confident. "I don't deny that he was good," she says of her father, who was a noted physician. "But such men turn their wives and daughters into slaves. They would rule the world if they could. But not ruling the world, they throw all the weight of their will on the necks and souls of women. But nature sometimes thwarts them." She believes that nature thwarted her father by making her, his only child, who happened to be a daughter, enough like him to be able to escape his dictatorship. Unlike Mordechai's expansive concept of the place of the Jews in world history and in the history of their time, Leonora is concerned strictly with her right to define and to control her destiny. Her father's Judaism might have prevented her from becoming the foremost actress of her time. So this is where the women's and the Jews' predicaments seem to converge, but without the kind of resolution that we find at the end of the philosopher's debate, when sympathies slide to the side of Mordechai. Leonora's anti-Jewish protest links her to Pash and Gideon's earlier objections to the recovery of Zion. On the women's theme, she is linked with Gwendolyn, who is equally striking, vivid, articulate, and likewise determined to be free of male encumbrance. There's so much in this novel that we are in danger of overlooking some of the most obvious aspects of it. The major figure in this novel is a woman, Gwendolyn Harleth. And one of the major subjects that George Eliot is exploring is what is happening to the modern woman. Here you have a real modern woman who is freed from certain constraints, who has, as she thinks, all of life to choose from, and has a lot of talent and a lot of charm and is able to get very far. This book is a real exploration of the women's question. So I think anyone who is interested in the modern women's lib movement, anyone who's interested in the role of women in modern society, could do a lot worse than to study this novel for what it really explores in a woman's consciousness, in her hopes of domination, in her dreams of being able to be free, but then raises the question of, hey, free from what? And what is this freedom going to lead to? And she is not the only female character in the book. There are a lot of females in the book. And if this weren't a book primarily about the Jewish question or about the rise of Jewish nationalism, one could say that it is to the same degree a novel about the women's question and what is the role of women in society and what does that have to do with Jewish nationalism. In fact, the book very richly sees the connection between a national self-consciousness and how a woman is going to realize herself individually in society. Leonora, you see, has the advantage over Gwendolyn of a clear ambition for which she has some training and considerable aptitude. She is more driven, more determined, more calculating, making sure to benefit from the marriage arranged by her father, than letting that marriage entrap her. The way Leonora directs her life, including giving up her son, earns her stardom and independence, unlike Mrs. Glasher, who deserted her son for a lover who then betrayed her. So Leonora's seems to be the modern woman's success story, if measured by societal standards of fame, wealth, social standing, domestic power. What gives her additional strength as a literary character is her confident bearing, in which there is no smidgen of regret. Now, she does have regrets. What does she regret? She regrets having given up her career when she suffered what turned out to be only a temporary impediment. When her voice was going, she thought this was permanent. So she gave up the theater. That she regrets because it turned out to be only a temporary thing. She could have made it back after all. But she offers her son no apology for having given him away, and she can hardly understand her own behavior in having belatedly summoned him to meet her. Taking the woman's perspective, this book gives us a full-throated protest against any civilization founded on traditional expectations regarding gender, race, class, occupation, religion, or nation. She becomes a princess in Russia, and yet she does not prevail. Ironically, she is tripped up by the very principles of kinship and blood that so much offend her. Daniel's curiosity once takes him into a synagogue in Frankfurt, and there he is recognized by a friend of his grandfather's through a physical resemblance so strong that the man follows him to check, to ascertain the connection that he strongly suspects. The bond that Joseph Kalonymus struck with his friend Daniel Charizi in their youth impels him to do whatever it takes to bring the grandson back to his heritage. So he goes in search of Leonora. He goes in search of her in Russia to try to awaken her conscience. Had she not fallen ill and become susceptible to such chastisement, Leonora might have thrown him out of the house together with the precious chest after him, or she might have burned the documents out of spite as she once did consider doing, but age and illness make her susceptible to intimations of death. And here is one of those subtle connections that we find. Just as Gwendolyn is haunted by the face of her dead husband appealing to her from the water, so Princess Halm Eberstein is haunted by this image of her father asking her to do her duty to him. So she yields to this insistent old friend and resolves to return to her son the Jewish birthright that she tried to steal from him. And this is what brings about this scene of meeting, partial reconciliation. Now, since Judaism works through matrilineal transmission, and at this point, of course, in history, there was no question about that. The question of patrilineal descent in Judaism had not arisen. So since it was understood that Judaism works through matrilineal transmission, it accords women the ultimate power to eliminate the Jews by ceasing to have and to raise Jewish children. Or in this case, to ensure that their children cease to be Jews. Gwendolyn is similarly uninterested in having or raising children. And it only seems to matter less in her case because the British in the novel are still smugly secure in their numbers and in their insular strength. But the novel does alert us to the common problem of modern women who claim their freedom as freedom from family, freedom from nation. The damage that Gwendolyn does in this book is mostly to herself. Leonora denies that she has done any damage at all, but the novel shows the dangers and fallout to both individuals and their communities and their surroundings. So here is where we may feel most strongly the conservative undertow of this book, toward the role of women who are winning their right to choose. The term is anachronistic, but the concept is the same. There is no question, you see, in this book, there's no question of opposing this development, which the author and the book accept as a fact of life, as a feature of modern society. It's happening. It's just Leonora Halm Eberstein is there. She exists, she's powerful, and this is a voice that is there. There's no denying it. But let's not forget the words of Buchan, the sensible Scot at the Hand and Banner, who warns that change does not necessarily imply progress. And it's interesting how sometimes these little passages that can almost get completely lost take on such, really, such significance. So this is what he says in the course of that debate. "You're all agreed that societies change, not always and everywhere, but on the whole and in the long run. Now, with all deference, I would beg to observe that we have got to examine the nature of changes before we have a warrant to call them progress, which word is supposed to include a bettering, though I apprehend it to be ill-chosen for that purpose, since mere motion onward may carry us to a bog or a precipice. And the questions I would put are three. Is all change in the direction of progress? If not, how shall we discern which change is progress and which not? And thirdly, how far and in what ways can we act upon the course of change so as to promote it where it is beneficial and divert it where it is injurious?" Buchan fails to impose his method on the talk, but were we to pluck out epigraphs for our sessions, as Eliot does for her chapters, this warning against identifying change with human progress would take pride of place. The novel stands assertively and almost programmatically against the German reform movement's attempt to strip Judaism of its national political aspect. The very title of that movement, Reform, advertised itself as progress, yet Deronda exposes it as injurious error. And I believe that the book stands no less resolutely against the attempt to identify progress with liberating women from their nurturing image and role. Deronda tells Gwendolyn that he hoped women would make men better, and this very much in the Victorian tradition of thinking that this was one of the things that women did. They were there to make men better. We can talk a great deal about how true that observation is in the sense of women civilizing men in some real way, and what happens to societies where people do not marry, and when there are many, 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 many young men without mates, without females to play this kind of role. So, and I would say that if Daniel takes on that role instead of Gwendolyn, a role that makes him seem effeminate, it may be because some of the women around him are abdicating it. In any case, the biblical matriarch Rachel is portrayed by the prophet Jeremiah as mourning the eclipse of the Jewish people. Thus saith the Lord, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping. Rachel, weeping for her children, refused to be comforted for her children because they were not. And so the return of the Jews to Zion was thereafter associated by passing Rachel's tomb, which also became, by the way, a place of pilgrimage for barren women who wished to conceive. So as a consummate modern woman herself, George Eliot may have special insight into women like Leonora and Gwendolyn, and for all her artistic brilliance in giving them voice, she charts the damage that they do to the national prospects of both Jews and British society, to the nurturing necessity of human life. I think this is how the subject is presented in this book. And this may also be why the most intact and happy family in the book is that of the pawnbroker Ezra Cohn. Three generations living together, the grandmotherly grandmother, the proud mother and competent wife, with several children, including a boy who, however sporadically, is studying Hebrew, and a girl who is happy to show off her new frock. The Cones take in, and in their imperfect way, include the indigent Mordechai in their household. A critic suggests that this was Eliot's response to Charles Dickens' frightful portrayal of Fagin, the dealer in stolen goods, who takes in children like Oliver Twist in order to school them in crime. The portrayal of the Cohn family certainly does form part of the novel's attempt to reform British attitudes towards the Jews, but it's also a contrast to what we see in Christian families in Britain, none of which seems to be as wholesome. To be sure, remember, the Cones have a daughter who took a bad turn. Do we know exactly what happened to her? We don't, but we know that this was not death. She went some evil way, right? And Sir Hugo's philandering seems to have ended by the time he married and began siring a family. So wrongdoing and kindnesses are equally distributed among Christians and Jews. But Mira's standard of family loyalty, Mordechai's standard of national loyalty, and the Cohn family's traditionally Jewish way of life reflect an intact culture of interconnectedness in which every level of community reinforces every other. I would say, in Robert Putnam's terms, the Jews benefit from their very heavy investment in social capital. Leonora does not repent of her decision. She does not confess to having wronged her son. Rather, she recognizes that she had gained as much potential for misery as for happiness, and she is left also seeming to have nothing valuable beyond herself. She is left at the end as a rather lonely woman, even though we know that she is returning to a family and children. It's hard to know how much the impulse behind George Eliot's novel was her expressed wish to correct this misinformed and antagonistic British public about the Jews, or whether she also hoped that this parallel and intertwined novel might be a corrective to the waning collective consciousness and social capital among her own people. The conception of this book is by no means simple. No character is really flawless, and with the exception of Grandcourt, and probably also Father Lapidot, no character is irredeemable. One scholar noted, this is interesting, that no one in George Eliot's novels ever sins and escapes. So along those lines, the sufferings of Gwendolyn and Princess Helm Eberstein might be conceived as a form of authorial punishment for their egocentricity, but they are at the same time, come back to this, they are really, more than arguably, the book's liveliest portrayals, as if to engage in the difficulties they face were at least as important as anyone else's solution to those difficulties. In the real world, many difficulties have no solution. Daniel instructs these women on how they can yet or might have done better, but he cannot save them. He cannot ultimately be their savior, neither of the one who let him go, nor the one who cannot let him go. Their loneliness endures, and only his sympathies remain. So to return to Blake's question, whether the poet is of the devil's party without knowing it, I would put it differently and less dramatically and less contentiously. You can argue your position most effectively if you understand what persuades those who argue against you. The argument at the Hand and Banner does that in the political sphere, in the male sphere, in the debate. But the princess makes the case for her conception of freedom with all her heart and soul and mind aligned against the constricting aspects of the ideal of Jewish nationalism that the novel otherwise commends to us. It is magnificent. And I would say that for anyone who has read this, nothing that has subsequently happened in the women's movement has ever surprised us. So I'll end with that. So here you have a book which is reaching for family, community, subordinating some of your individual needs to those of a larger constituency, feeling the idea of how important national continuity is, and not just your individual liberation. So the book stands for all these things, and yet here is one of its strongest characters, its most memorable characters, who represents just the opposite.
For additional information about the Tikva Fund, please visit tikvafund.org.